Now in his fourth and final term representing Connecticut in the United States Senate, Joseph Lieberman has a national reputation as a thoughtful, principled, and effective legislator. Senator Lieberman is perhaps best known as the Democratic candidate for vice president in the year 2000. Officially listed in the Senate records as, quote, an independent Democrat, close quote, he is a national leader who works across party lines to find common ground. He is a vocal advocate and has written extensively on the dignity and nobility of public service. He urges us all to be true to our tradition of tolerance by giving faith in its practitioners a place at the national table. Senator Lieberman is also one of Congress's most influential voices on security issues. He was the Senate's leading champion of legislation creating the Department of Homeland Security to better protect the nation from terrorist attacks. He has been at the forefront of efforts not only to increase our investment in defense, but to transform our armed forces to better meet the threats of the 21st century. He is also the author of a wonderful new book, The Gift of Rest, which challenges us all to rediscover the beauty of the Sabbath. Senator Lieberman lives in Stamford, Connecticut, and Washington, D.C., with his wife, Hadassah. Together, they are the proud parents of 4 children and 11 grandchildren. Please join me in welcoming Senator Joseph Lieberman to Brigham Young University.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much, President Samuelson, for that introduction. Thank you all for that extremely warm welcome. It's just great to be here at this beautiful and storied Brigham Young campus. I must say, Mr. President, that in listening to your introduction, which was very generous, I thought back a few years ago to an occasion in Washington, D.C., where the former Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, was the keynote speaker. And the chairman of the meeting got up at the moment Kissinger was going to speak and said, Henry Kissinger really needs no introduction, so I give you Dr. Henry Kissinger. Kissinger got up and said in his inimitable voice, it's probably true that I do not need an introduction, but you know, it's also true that I like a good introduction. Mr. President, that was a great introduction from a great man who honored me with a comment that appears in the front of the book, The Gift of Rest, and has done such an extraordinary job here at BYU. I have the greatest admiration for this university's work in educating minds, ennobling spirits, and inspiring in its students a commitment, a real-life commitment to the words etched in stone at the entrance of this great campus, enter to learn, go forth to serve. I will come back to that. Let me now personally thank Elder L. Tom Perry and Elder Quentin L. Cook of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles for being here this morning and for their leadership in the Church of Latter-day Saints. I'm truly honored by their presence and very grateful for the opportunity we had to speak for a few moments before this forum began. It is the faith of the church that has inspired, informed, and energized this great university and succeeding generations of its graduates. The Spirit of God fills this campus, and with it, I can tell you today, I feel an ecumenical spirit. I feel that ecumenical spirit so deeply that I'm going to venture forth and take the risk of telling a joke. An ecumenical joke. Now, perhaps some of you have heard it. If you haven't, I hope you enjoy it. This is the story of the day when the chief rabbi of Israel called the Pope, chief rabbi in Jerusalem, called the Pope in the Vatican and said, Your Holiness, I have good news and bad news to tell you. And which would you like to hear first? And the Pope said to the chief rabbi, I'd like to hear the good news first. So the rabbi said to the Pope, Well, here's the good news. I can tell you for a certainty that the Savior is coming to earth tomorrow. Now, we have a minor doctrinal dispute about whether this is the first or the second coming, but then that we'll be able to handle that. So the Pope said, that is not just good news, that's the greatest news. That's the news that we've all been waiting to hear. What possibly could be the bad news? Well, the chief rabbi said, apparently he's going to Salt Lake City. Thank you for laughing. I do feel a special connection to the Mormon faith and to BYU because of the core principles this university stands for, which are at once rooted in the tradition of the Mormon faith, but also clearly shared by, I would say, most Americans, and I would say certainly most religiously observant Jewish Americans. Throughout my life, I've been blessed to experience the bond that exists between people of faith whose faiths are different. And I have felt that in my life with Mormons that I've been privileged to know, have as friends, or to work with. People of faith share a lot, beginning with our gratitude for what we've been given. First and foremost, our lives. We believe in what both the Bible and the Declaration of Independence tells us, that as the Bible, of course, makes clear, we are not here by accident, but because of a divine, godly act of creation. And as the Declaration, written by men of faith, tells us, every one of us is a child of God. And as such, each and every one of us has inalienable rights by birth to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We believe that each of us with those rights also has responsibilities that are articulated in our faiths. And each of us has a destiny, and that this great nation of ours itself has a destiny. That's why I'm so pleased that you have asked me this morning to speak about faith in the public square, faith in the American public square. It is a subject that I've thought about a lot, written about a little bit, and lived a lot in what I think is a classically and wonderfully American way. My Jewish faith is central to my life. I was raised in a religiously observant family, given to me by my parents and informed by my rabbis. My faith has provided me with a foundation, an order, a sense of purpose in my life. It has much to do with the way I strive to navigate in a constructive way through every day, both personally and professionally, in ways that are large and small. One of the central observances of my faith, and also, of course, of the Mormon faith, is the observance of the Sabbath. To remember the Sabbath day, as the commandment says, to keep it holy. As President Samuelson has been kind enough to say, my observance of the Sabbath is the subject of this book I've written called The Gift of Rest, Rediscovering the Beauty of the Sabbath. Now, I know that some people have asked, why would a United States senator write a book about a religious subject like the Sabbath? It's a good question. It's very different than anything I've ever written, and I think while people in Connecticut certainly know that I'm Sabbath observant, and perhaps people around the country because of my vice presidential campaign in 2000 also know that I'm Sabbath observant, I never really was asked to talk a lot more than that about it. I think people probably know what I don't do from Friday night sundown to Saturday night sundown, which is I don't work unless there's an emergency of some kind. But they don't know what I do. And so I decided to write this book to try to share what I call the gift of Sabbath rest. And it is interesting that the Sabbath is observed by all of us as the result of a commandment in the Bible that God gave to Moses. But I know that many of you who observe the Sabbath, as I and my family, though it started as a directive, if you will, we experience it as a gift. The Talmud, a rabbi of centuries and centuries ago imagines a conversation between God and Moses in which God says, "Moses, in my storehouse, I have a very special gift for you. It is called the Sabbath." And I decided to write this book because I think Sabbath observance has diminished in our country over the course of my life, and the country has lost as a result of that. I also believe, though, this day, this institution, is thousands of years old, it is probably more relevant and necessary today than ever before. And not just in a religious sense, but really in the quality of life sense, because we're all working so hard, and we never get away from work because we can, unless we choose to, because we always have our cell phone, our BlackBerry, our iPad, our iPhone, whatever, with us. So I hoped in bringing, this book is really an attempt to invite the reader to come with my wife, my family, and me through a typical Sabbath day observed according to a traditional Jewish practice, but I'm writing this book, well, in part for Jews who may not be observing Sabbath as much as I would like, but really for people of all faiths, hope, and in some sense for people of no particular faith, hoping that they will decide to accept the gift in whole or in part and bring it into their lives. My Sabbath observance at different times in my career has, of course, intersected with my political life and governmental responsibility because it's different than the rules that most people live by. So when I first ran for office way back in the 1970s, and I was lucky enough to become a state senator in Connecticut. When people would, I made an early decision that I would never be involved in politics on the Sabbath. If I held an office that had governmental responsibility that I couldn't delegate, such as voting as a senator or going to a meeting about a national security crisis, I would do that because I was instructed by my rabbis that when life intersects with religious law, life has to triumph, particularly on the Sabbath, which, after all, is a day in which we are honoring God's creation of life and how inconsistent it would be if one has the opportunity to protect life, protect security, to not do that in observance of a religious law that's meant to commemorate the Sabbath. So early on, when I was a state senator and people would ask me to a political event on the Sabbath or to a testimonial dinner, and I'd say no, sometimes they were puzzled. Other times they were just plain angry. I would have to explain why. But I can tell you over time, as they realized I was giving these answers and saying I couldn't come as a matter of religious observance and belief, and that I was doing it consistently, they accepted it and respected it. I was different than most of them in those practices, but in the spirit, as I'll say in a moment, that I think is fundamentally American, those differences did not get in the way of them respecting my beliefs and supporting my career, and in some sense even feeling that interfaith bond, because though we were of different faiths, we were joined in classically American style by a shared belief in God and everything that comes from that. So we are now at the start of a presidential campaign in which discussions and debates about the relationship between politics and religion, about the proper place of faith in the public square, have already begun to play a prominent role. These are not new questions. They are very old. They go back to the founders of our country who wrote the Declaration and later the Constitution. And the words of our founders are relevant because they remind us from the beginning of America that we have been a nation that has defined itself not so much by our geographical borders as by our national values. And one of those values was and is a belief shared by most Americans that there is a God. Now, I know that may be controversial to some, because though we have that belief, we respect the rights of those who don't share that belief. But the United States was, as the Declaration of Independence says, secured. The line is, in order to secure the rights that are mentioned in the first graph of our first document, the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which are the endowment of our Creator, that the new nation, the United States of America, was being formed. I always like to say that the truth is that America has been, from the beginning, a faith-based initiative. And anybody who tries to separate faith from America's public square is doing something unnatural and ultimately bad for our country. Our founders were all men of a particular Christian disposition, mostly Protestant. And so you have to give them extraordinary credit that when it came to religion, the remarkable documents they wrote and embraced guaranteed religious freedom for everyone, not just people who shared their faith, prohibited the establishment of any one religion, that is, that there'd be an official religion, although they might have been tempted to do that, you might say, and still give others freedom of religion, but there'd be an official religion. No, they didn't do that, even though they were and are now Christians, a large majority in this country. They were remarkable people. The First Amendment of our Constitution that prohibits the establishment of an official religion ensures for every American the right to worship, or as I said, not to worship, as he or she chooses. I always delighted me really one day when I thought that one of the rights to liberty that our Creator has endowed us with is the right not to believe in the Creator. Now, that's not a right that many Americans exercise, but it's a measure of the breadth of the vision of the founders that it's so. In Article 6 of the Constitution of the United States, the founders did something else quite specific to guarantee this vision. They protected every American from religious discrimination in politics by prohibiting what they called religious tests for public office. The truth is that in many of the original colonies of the United States, there were laws saying that you had to be of a particular Christian denomination to run for public office. But the founders wanted to rise above that quite remarkably. Succeeding generations have been inspired by this founding vision, and I think endeavored to make real its promise, the promise of what I call freedom of religion, not freedom from religion. Our unique constitutional history that I've just described created, in turn, a unique American public square in which there is no establishment of one religion, freedom of all religions, but there is the presence of religion in our public life. The greatest laws that are written, including our Constitution, are the ones that are so broadly accepted by the people of a nation as ours that they become not just laws that one feels compelled to follow because they're in the law, but they become part of the fiber of the country. They become part of our national system of ethics. And I think so, too, is it with freedom of religion. Alexis de Tocqueville, the famous French student of America, noted the remarkable religiosity of Americans in his definitive account of the United States written in the 19th century. He wrote that there's no country that he had ever seen in which religion, I quote, retains greater influence over the souls of men, I would add now women, too, than in America, end quote. And added that, quote, there can be no greater proof of its utility and its conformity to human nature than that its influence is powerfully felt over the most enlightened and free nation on earth, end of quote. I think that's still true today. I saw a recent independent public opinion poll that said that over 90% of Americans say they believe in God. I'm always encouraged to see how far ahead of politicians God is running in those polls. And the majority of Americans say that they regularly attend a house of worship. De Tocqueville also observed that though Americans were divided into many different religious sects, as he called them, they all, he and I quote here, look upon their religion in the same light. He recognized that though Americans follow many different belief systems, there are universal values that unite us all. And that is a second consequence of our country's unique commitment to freedom of religion, but not freedom from religion. Religious freedom in America has led to a in the public square to a set of shared values that were obviously evident in the 19th century, and I think at our best moments remain so today. President Lincoln called this America's political religion. And the poet Walt Whitman praised what he called a sublime and serious religious democracy in America. In American history, this sublime and serious combination of religion and democracy has overall been a force for great good. Some of the most important movements of conscience in our history emerge from the convictions of religious people and use the language and liturgy of faith to build popular support. I'm thinking of the abolitionist movement in the 19th century that led to the end of the evil of slavery. It was that same spirit that motivated much of the suffragist movement in the early part of the 20th century that fought for and won rights for women in our country. And it was that same spirit that I was personally privileged to witness when I was a college student in the 60s and participated in the civil rights movement led by a religious figure, Dr. Martin Luther King, who invoked America's political religion, as Lincoln called it, in advancing that noble cause. I myself was inspired to join that movement because of the values it represented, which were deeply rooted in my own faith and religious history, the values of equality, of service, of tolerance, and of respect for law. It was also while I was at college that another important barrier in America was broken. In the fall of my freshman year, a Roman Catholic, John F. Kennedy, was elected to the presidency of the United States for the first time in American history. I will tell you, as a young Jewish American, not thinking of a political career, believe me, at age 18, when he won, I had some sense that doors had opened for me, that somehow horizon had expanded for me, and for others who were from faiths that were not the majority, from races or other nationalities. I didn't know how or where that might help happen, but I felt inspired and empowered by Kennedy's election. At that point, I certainly wasn't dreaming yet of being a senator, and I never could have imagined what happened to me in 2000. In 2000, then-Vice President Gore gave me the privilege of being the first Jewish American to be nominated for national office when he asked me to be his vice presidential running mate. And that year, I will tell you, I personally experienced so much of what I have described up until now, the American people's generosity of fairness, acceptance, and acceptance of religious diversity. The Reverend Jesse Jackson said on the day that I was nominated, in America, when a barrier is broken for one group, the doors of opportunity open wider for every other American. I felt that shared sense of progress throughout the campaign. I also felt free, as somebody noted recently, freer than Kennedy did in some ways, to talk about my religion and the central role of faith in my life. I write about all this in the book, but I want to just share a few anecdotes with you from it that make a larger point, I hope, about the constructive role of faith in America's public square. There was a Secret Service agent who traveled with me during that campaign. He had worked several national campaigns before, and he told me one day that he had never heard so many people saying to a candidate, "God bless you." Well, I thought about that, and I honestly think it's a reflection of Christian Americans saying to me in those magical words, "God bless you," we know you're a religious person. We know you don't have exactly the same religious faith or observance that we do, but we know we share a common history, and we're glad you're running. On another occasion, in a slightly more humorous way, I remember speaking to a rally of Latino Americans and seeing in the front row a woman who had created a poster which vividly expressed this sense of shared values and rising together that I'm speaking of now in two powerful words that I don't think ever appeared together before. And those two words were, "Viva chutzpah." That said it all. Now, in the end, the Gore-Lieberman ticket actually received over 500,000 more votes than the Bush-Cheney ticket, something I enjoyed reminding President Bush and Vice President Cheney of very often. Now, believe me, thank you. Believe me, I do not cite these numbers to relitigate that small matter of Florida's electoral votes, but because I think, like sports, politics ultimately comes down to numbers. So I cite those 500,000 votes as the best, and really to me, and I hope everybody, inspiring evidence, unambiguous evidence, that our ticket was judged on the basis of our qualifications and policies, and most definitely not on the basis of my religion. Because my religion is different, as I said before. And as I get to the next section of what I want to say, let me just describe some of the ways in which my religion is different. You know, there's a code, there are rules. There are rules that rabbis created over the centuries to define some of the basic principles in the Torah, in the Hebrew Bible, in the Old Testament, which are not always, all the spaces are not always filled in. So, for instance, we have pretty rigid rules for observant Jews about what we can eat and drink and when. Observant Jews, particularly women, have a dress code that they're supposed to follow. Probably not known by many people that there are even a prescription for Jewish men to wear a particular undergarment. Is this beginning to sound familiar? We have different practices. But the great thing that I experienced in 2000 was that those practices were set aside because of all we shared, but also because of our national ideals of religious freedom and no religious test for public office. So in this 2000 presidential election cycle, faith and politics are again going to have become a source of some controversy. First, in the expression that some people have given to their faith, particularly Governor Perry and Congresswoman Backman, some people have real anxiety about that. I don't share that anxiety. A candidate, it seems to me, doesn't give up their freedom of religion or freedom of expression when they decide to run for office. They have the right, if they choose to talk about the role that faith plays in their life, understanding that others, voters, have the right to decide based on those expressions whether that affects their view of those candidates. I will tell you personally that I always welcome the opportunity to hear about a candidate's faith and what it means to them, because I think it helps me understand them as people better. The second religious controversy in the 2012 campaign is, of course, close to BYU. And it is that two members of the Church of Latter-day Saints are running for president, Governor Romney and Governor Huntsman. And one of them, Governor Romney, a distinguished graduate of this university, may well end up as the Republican nominee. In these Republican primary campaigns, and in the general election, if Governor Romney is nominated, Americans are going to be challenged again to be true to our founding principles of equality of opportunity and the clear prohibition in the Constitution, Article 6, of a religious test being applied for public office. In 1960, when Kennedy was running for president, there was still significant anti-Catholic prejudice in America. On the eve of the vote, he spoke about this, and his words remain quite relevant today, but I think this time more relevant to Governor Romney and Governor Huntsman, at least based on some of what I consider to be the prejudiced things that have been said about their faith and its relevance to this campaign. President Kennedy said in the 1960 campaign, and I quote, "If this election is decided on the basis that 40 million Americans who happen to be Catholic lost their chance of being president on the day they were baptized, then it is the whole nation that will be the loser. In the eyes of Catholics and non-Catholics around the world, in the eyes of history, and in the eyes of our own people." End quote. And, of course, the same will be true if Americans judge Governor Romney or Governor Huntsman in the primaries or the general election based on their Mormon faith and not on their personal qualities and their ideals and ideas for office. Just as Americans rose above their prejudices or their discomfort at the differences, as I've described them, when Kennedy's Roman Catholic faith was different in 1960 and 16 years later when Jimmy Carter's Christian evangelical faith was different, and again in 2000, when my Jewish faith was different, so too must Governor Romney be judged not on the basis of his faith, which may be different to many, but on his personal qualities, his leadership, his experience, and, as I've said, his ideas for America's future. My personal experience in 2000, which I've described to you today, gives me great confidence that the voters will again reject any sectarian religious test and show their strong character, their instinctive fairness, and their steadfast belief in the ideals of the Declaration and the Constitution. And when they do, another barrier may well be broken for another group in America, and the doors of opportunity will thereby open wider for every American. Now let me conclude by saying just one more way in which I believe that faith in the public square is profoundly important, not just to the current campaign, but this current difficult time in American life. time when millions of Americans can't find work, when millions of other Americans who have work are worried about whether they'll still have their jobs next year, when a shocking number of Americans have lost the characteristic American optimism in America's future, when all too many Americans, an overwhelming majority, unfortunately for reasons that are understandable, have lost confidence in our government. And many, both here at home and among our enemies in the world, believe that America has begun an irreversible decline. In my opinion, this pessimism is absolutely unjustified, unjustified by fact or history. I believe that this 21st century will be another great century for America. But to make it so, we've got to regain confidence in ourselves. And one of the big reasons for my optimism is those numbers I cited earlier, that more than 90% of the American people believe in God, and more than half of Americans say they regularly attend houses of worship. Why is that important? Well, to me, it's important, and we have to come back to it as a people, to connect our faith with our feeling about our national future. It's important because faith generally leads to hope. And as members of the LDS Church that I've known show every day in their lives, the combination of faith, which leads to hope, and good values and hard work produces amazingly great results. Faith in God, love of country, sense of unity, confidence in the power of every individual. These are the things that have carried the American people through crises greater than the ones we face today, and will, I'm sure, propel us forward to a better place if only we will return to those values and recognize them as a source of national strength. And I hope in some sense the presence of faith in the public square will let us do that. The greatest source of America's strength and hope for the future is not in the current divisive and rigid politics of Washington. It is in the broadly shared faith and values of the American people. And the reasons for unity and inspiration to service so many of us find in the varied houses of worship we attend in this country. We need America's faith and values to be brought to Washington. We come to Congress and to the White House, to the administration, as generally people of faith, and yet it seems to me when we get there, we don't act as if those principles that I've just talked about guide our lives. I will say to you, here in this great center, for a long, long time now, Brigham Young University has produced graduates who have understood all this and spread progress and growth throughout our country and indeed the world. And as the old poster used to say of Uncle Sam, your country needs you now and what you believe in more than ever. I'm confident that when you go forth from these gates, moved by your faith and enabled by the education you receive here, your work and your service will help make America not only better, but the more perfect union we have always aspired to be. I thank you from the bottom of my heart for this great honor and opportunity to be with you this morning, and I pray with you that God will bless us all in our great country, now and into the future. Thank you very, very much.